Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Mark Mazower on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Hitler's Empire, How the Nazis Ruled Europe. I'm a student of the topic myself, and I was very keen to read the book, and think it was absolutely terrific. Mark is an expert on German history, and he also is an expert on Greek history, and he's quite well known for his interpretation of 20th century European history, Dark Continent, another book that I highly recommend. So it was my great pleasure to talk to Mark today. I hope you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Good, very good. I should tell our listeners that we have Mark Mazower on the show today, and we'll be talking about his book, Hitler's Empire, How the Nazis Ruled Europe. I've read the book, and it's really quite an extraordinary piece of work. I enjoyed it very much, and I'm really pleased and honored to have Mark on the show today, and I imagine that everybody is going to enjoy the interview. Mark, if you could do us the favor of beginning by telling us just a little bit about yourself, where you grew up and where you went to school and that kind of thing.
Sure. I'm a Brit. I was born and grew up in London, went to schools there, and went to university at Oxford, and read classics and philosophy there,
mm-hmm.
and then wandered about a bit. I spent 2 years in Bologna, Italy,
mm-hmm.
Went back and did my PhD at Oxford, and spent a year in Greece,
mm-hmm.
As part of my research time for that.
Mm-hmm. And who did you work with at Oxford? Who was your advisor there?
I was very lucky. I had an anthropologist called John Campbell,
mm-hmm.
Who was a student of Evans Pritchard.
Mm-hmm.
Greece is a small country, and not many people work on Greece either in the UK or the US. And he was one of the very few people who was willing to take doctoral students. And he was from that generation of anthropologists who regarded themselves as historians as well.
Mm-hmm.
He'd gone to Greece for the first time, I think, with the British troops at the end of the Second World War.
Oh, really? Uh-huh. Yeah.
And had then written an important book on clientelism and patronage in Greece in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
Which was formative, really, in shaping a whole perspective on the Mediterranean at that time,
mm-hmm.
and I worked with him.
And how did you become interested in Greece, particularly?
Two things, really. I'd read classics as an undergraduate. That was the first time
mm-hmm.
that I went to Greece, was in connection with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to Italy to do my MA in Bologna, I thought, well, the Mediterranean is a nice place. I need an excuse to keep coming back here. And
yeah.
The only question in my mind was, should it be Italy or should it be Greece? And I enjoyed Bologna very much, but I enjoyed Greece more.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 81. Papandreou and the PASOK government had just come into power. There was a lot of euphoria and perhaps naivete about them still. And there was a kind of optimism and full-bloodedness about people's attitude to politics
mm-hmm.
that I liked, whereas
mm-hmm.
Italy at that time, and even more today, I guess, there was a deeply cynical and world-weary feeling towards the politicians in Rome, for
mm-hmm.
completely understandable reasons, by the way. And I understood that, but found it depressing.
Mm-hmm.
And preferred the energy of Greece.
Yeah,
and that was how I ended up there.
That's a good reason to choose a topic. I don't know how it happened, but I ended up with Russia, and I don't know why.
Well, I'll tell you how it happened. I'll tell you how it. I mean, you were probably the product of a highly professionalized graduate education system, whereas I was the product of a completely unprofessionalized graduate education system, where nobody ever discussed the likely job market with me, or pointed me in one direction or another, or noted that there were probably not ever going to be any jobs in modern Greek history
yeah.
at any serious university,
yeah.
and that was the precondition for being able to do it.
Well, it's funny. It's an interesting point, because although I am the product of a highly professional PhD program, and you're right to say that we were thinking about jobs, and the Cold War was on at the time. In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, we were all rather in mourning, because, as a friend of mine used to say, the Russia just became India, and most departments only have one Indian historian. So.
Well, of course, now it's not so bad to be Indian. No. And anyway, it's back to being Russia again.
No, it's true, and that's kind of nice in a way. I guess nice for me, but not nice for them.
Not nice for the Georgians.
Yeah, no, not at all. So your first book, if I recall, was on the Nazi occupation of Greece. Is that right?
Well, there was, in fact, an incredibly boring thesis book even before that.
Oh, really? Okay, I don't know about that one.
Which was on interwar Greece, on the economic crisis and the drift towards authoritarianism. But the first book that was halfway readable came after that and was about the German occupation of Greece. That's right.
Yeah, and so that provided you kind of a platform for writing this book. But then in between you wrote Dark Continent, for which you are quite well known, I think. Is that right?
I found that although my expertise was on Greece, almost nobody in the university world was particularly interested in it, and that meant that I did very little teaching on modern Greece, and I tended to teach broad course survey courses on Europe, and that got me thinking about European history. And in fact, my first teaching job was in an international relations department where I taught a survey course on Europe that ran through the 45 divide up until the present. And that's what made me think there really isn't very much around at the time that I was teaching that I could give students that was a kind of historical synthesis of the entire 20th century. And the convention was somehow, if you didn't stop at 45, you regarded the Cold War period in a different vein and not really as history at all, but sort of politics or social science.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that experience of teaching and of not having stimulating materials that thought through the 20th century as a whole is what prompted me to write Dark Continent. Intellectually, it was for me, it was a very valuable experience.
Yeah, the book was quite a revelation to me. I suppose it was because I went to that highly professional PhD program. I recall quite vividly, and I hope I'm not mistaking this, some of the things that you said about interwar Europe particularly and the popularity of fascism among all kinds of people that we don't associate with fascism, including Churchill. So,
yes.
Yeah, I remember, I believe there's a passage in there that talks about Churchill going to Italy or talking about the Italians and explaining how democracy really wasn't for them. Is that right? Yeah, no, that's a...
Some of the book was the product of thinking about Greek history. In other words, you escaped some of the paradigms that shape German or French history, but German history in particular, where the whole issue becomes how do you explain this exceptional event, which is the rise of Nazism. But, I mean, there were many other countries. To me, it was obvious that there were many other countries that had gone right. And in what you might call a very natural way, Greece was one of them. Nobody in Greece ever sat around wondering how democracy had failed and how on earth the right had come to power. It was perfectly obvious that the democratic system in the interwar period was a complete mess.
Yeah.
And so that was a kind of shift of perspective that, in fact, studying this very small, marginal country facilitated. And so in that sense, I became aware of how much a certain broader paradigm could be the result of focusing on just one or two big powers. And in fact, if you were familiar with the history of other countries, you've got a completely different take on the whole story, not just the story of that country.
No, I quite agree with that. But it was a useful corrective to the things, almost boosterish things that I had read in that professional PhD program about the march of democracy through time. Because, of course, you know, as an Eastern European historian myself, I knew that Wilsonianism was more or less a disaster in Eastern Europe and was abandoned quite quickly and for some good reasons. So, I recommend the book to anyone. And like I told you in the pre-interview, I taught the book. I used it in a survey course, and it worked out very well. So if there's anyone teaching survey courses, I counsel them to get it. But let's move on, actually, to this new book, Hitler's Empire, How the Nazis Ruled Europe. How did you come to write that?
Well, it struck me that, oddly enough, there was no single work. In fact, there isn't a single authored work since the war, I think, perhaps one that I can think of, that attempts to look at the entire European experience under the Nazis. And there's an enormous amount of work on different bits of this,
mm-hmm.
but I think the consequence of that is segmentation and lack of an overall interpretation,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I wanted to try to provide and to think through for myself, in a sense, in a kind of return to one of the central chapters of Dark Continent, but expanding it and linking it up to a number of issues that were much more on my mind now than they had been then. For instance, Europe's relationship to the rest of the world and the issue of imperialism in particular, which didn't figure very large in Dark Continent, but
mm-hmm.
But seemed more and more important as I came to think about the Nazi New Order. Now, the book is not a total history of Europe's experience under Nazism. Rather, it's a study of Nazi rule,
mm-hmm.
of what they thought they were doing when they ruled, of what they did, attempting in the process, I think, to see Europe as a whole and to ask, you know, how did they see Europe as a whole? What did they want from Europe, if anything?
Mm-hmm.
How well did they think they were doing?
Mm-hmm.
I find that a lot of the discussion of the war, perhaps because the Holocaust has come to center stage in our thinking about the war,
mm-hmm.
has acquired a highly moralistic tone. The
mm-hmm.
war is kind of plumbed for moral lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted, in a way, to put all of that to one side and turn the Nazis, as far as one could, which isn't very easy, into kind of boring management consultants offering a different kind of set of techniques of rule and occupation.
Yeah, no,
and
yeah.
I guess, you know, this was against the backdrop of Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and the occupation of Iraq, and therefore military occupation as such became an urgent question to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's what the Nazis essentially were doing.
Mm-hmm.
What was their philosophy of occupation? And
mm-hmm.
you know, then one finds it varies enormously from place to place and time to time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think that's right. I know that in my own readings of German history, which I actually are quite extensive, I sort of started my historical career as somebody who was very interested in World War II, as many
yeah.
Americans do. You know, I tended to think of the Nazis from a very German perspective. Now, of course, they
right.
were German nationalists, so on and so forth, but we tend to forget, I think, the degree to which they talked about being Europeans,
yes.
and they thought they were fighting for Europe. Now, I don't know whether that was cynical or not. I tend to think not, but they did think a lot about Europe as a whole.
They thought about Europe, and even more than they thought about Europe, well, they were in Europe.
Yes,
they weren't
right.
just in
yeah.
Germany.
yeah, no.
And you wouldn't always
right.
guess that from the way German historians write about them.
No, that's true.
And therefore, they, whether or not they were thinking about Europe as such, and some of them were thinking about a lot, and some of them were just paying lip service to it,
mm-hmm.
there they were in Estonia or Serbia or Western France, and they had to do something about that. They had to work out what they thought of the people, how they intended to rule them, what the short and long run policies were, how these fitted into whatever the long run goals of the regime actually were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this wonderful thing that the Foreign Office interpreter Schmidt says about the Nazis, where he says, you know, they were always talking about a 1,000-year Reich, but they couldn't plan ahead for 5 minutes. So one had to resist the temptation in taking their planning too seriously. But nevertheless, they were spending a lot of time talking about
mm-hmm.
planning for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what they did only made sense if you thought about it in terms of a longer-run political project, the Holocaust being the most obvious example, but
mm-hmm.
there being many, many others as well.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's exactly right. Let's talk a little bit about where you begin the book, and that is with Bismarck and in the 19th century and German attitudes toward the Slavs in particular. This is something I know a little bit about, again, as an Eastern European historian, but I think many of our listeners will not, because the Germans had some definite ideas about the way German power should be projected into Eastern Europe. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the continuities between Bismarck's ideas and those of the Nazis.
Well, one of the things, as somebody interested in Eastern Europe, that always, frankly, left me gobsmacked about the historiography on the rise of the Nazis is all these studies on why the Nazis came to power were highly internalist. They came to power because this class or that class voted
mm-hmm.
for them, because of this or that economic program. They rarely seem to mention foreign policy, and in particular the issue of the German minorities left on the eastern borderlands after 1918, which was obviously a major issue. And in from which point of view, the Nazis looked like very extreme German nationalists, but part of a much broader set of opinions. So it was obvious to me that for the Nazis, one of the key points of coming into power was to win back the territories that they had lost in 1918, and then having won those back and added to them, to, as they saw it, improve on the Bismarckian state by making sure that nothing like that could ever happen again. So that you couldn't really understand the Nazi New Order except as an implied critique of the Bismarckian state. And they read their Max Weber on the German-Polish problem, on his critique of why a capitalist state must fail to nationalize a territory, and they say, yeah, he's right, and we can do better because we have a strong state. So they were deeply interested in this, and that seemed to me a useful starting point. That is to say, to make the starting point of the war, all starting points are arbitrary, a history of the German-Polish, in particular, antagonism that, of course, stretched back to the Bismarckian period and arguably even earlier than that. That's why I began there, because it was that borderland issue that crystallized for me what spurred the Nazis and actually what made them popular.
I see just what you mean. So when, let me ask you a question that may sound naive. I think I might know the answer to it, but maybe our listeners won't. When Hitler embarked on his imperialistic war, did he have a plan as to what Europe would look like after he was done?
No.
there. Well, that's next question.
I see no evidence that he had even realized that there were more than 2.5 million or so Jews in Poland at the time that he invaded it. So, a plan? No. A set of preoccupations? And yes. And obviously, if you read Mein Kampf, those are very clear. It's clear what he regarded as the central historical struggle of the epoch. It's clear that he believed that Germany had to be strong enough to push the Slavs back. That implied some kind of empire in the East. All of that is clear. But where the borders were going to be, what the racial policy was going to be towards the people who were there, above all, what the implications for the Western border were, none of that was clear. And what's breathtaking is the lack of forethought, the lack of planning. One of the what looks like one of the major planned episodes of the early part of the war, which are the huge forced population movements, the repatriation of Germans from Eastern Europe and from Italy from October 1939 onwards, that helps Himmler and the SS assert themselves as the central agency in the war effort. None of that was planned. That was all the forcing of the Germans' hand by circumstances, in particular by a terrified reaction of the Germans in the Baltic states that the Soviets were going to come back in and wipe them out, and that they were going to face a kind of rerun of the situation of the end of the war in 1918. None of that had been foreseen in advance. There was a complete lack of clarity about Scandinavia. All the evidence is that the Nazis had no intention of invading the Balkans, that they would have liked to continue with some kind of domination through these bilateral clearing arrangements, through kind of economic power that they had been developing since the mid-1930s. So planned? Absolutely not.
So improvisation would be kind of a hallmark of the regime, and this would be consistent with what actually a lot of your fellow historians of Germany say, that is Kershaw and the rest of them, that they weren't exactly making it up as they went along. They had a kind of set of guiding principles, but they were overtaken by events, as you say.
You know, one of the historians that I found most helpful in thinking about this is Christopher Browning. I regard as exemplary in his work on the Holocaust. And he's shown, I think, very, very clearly how what ultimately happened to the Jews in Poland is really product of a set of unforeseen steps that the Germans take or are either pushed into and then take in order, in their terms, to solve the population problems of the territories they've conquered. And I think that was very characteristic of their modus operandi.
Yeah, no. The book that you're talking about, I think, I don't recall the name of it, but it's called Toward the Final Solution or something like this.
Well, yeah, The Origins of the Final Solution.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I finished it about a year ago, and I think that you're absolutely right. He spends what I think to most readers would be an inordinate amount of time talking about the attempt precisely to move these the Volksdeutsche to Poland, and then as a result, a kind of knock-on effect, having to remove all of
these
Poles, and they
exactly.
didn't know how to do that.
That's right.
Because it was such an incredible logistical task. And that is really, I think, kind of one of the, and it's an excellent book. I highly recommend it to anyone. One of the astounding things is that they face these challenges of moving really masses of people, and they, instead of drawing back and pulling up and looking at it, they actually just waded in and attempted to do these things.
Yes. No, one of the German generals says after the war, you know, we were building this empire in the most incredible hurry.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important to understanding their, I mean, that's part of the reason for the extremism. They were in a terrific hurry.
Yeah.
They thought this all had to be done before the window of opportunity closed.
That's right.
But then, of course, the other thing is, you know, they are in the grip of this very, very extreme set of beliefs, this extreme ideology, an ideology which often creates as many problems as it does solutions when you actually try to implement it, more problems than solutions, but which always prioritizes the use of force, which always prioritizes action and the exercise of will over rational debate and reflection. And at the very top of this state and in a position constitutionally of enormous power is one of the most radical figures of all, Hitler, who is always inclined to violence as a solution to problems. So if there's resistance to German rule in France, his solution is push the Wehrmacht into executing more people, not less. And he involves himself in these things. Similarly, on behind the Eastern Front, in the occupied Eastern territories, he's constantly radicalizing, constantly forcing and ratcheting up the levels of violence. So it's a combination, I think, of all these things.
No, I think that's right. One of the most extraordinary things your book points out, and I would also say that this is true of Browning's books and Kershaw's books, is the degree of ideological rigidity at the top and how that opens opportunities to people at lower echelons to do things that they had not imagined. So the signal is sent that it is, if a large number of Jews or Poles are inconvenient, they can be killed or starved or moved someplace. And I think that that allowance kind of further radicalizes the entire program until really it's basically everybody is fair game at a certain moment.
The radicalism is there, and it's most influential in shaping policy where that leadership is most directly interested. So there are many areas of occupied Europe where the regime is not terribly interested much of the time, or where its attention is fitful, and there's much greater scope for local commanders to do things differently, so that if you look at economic policy towards Belgian or Danish or Dutch corporations, I mean, you know, it's not exactly business as usual, but it's very different to Poland or the Ukraine. I mean, the Germans work with Belgian businessmen, and Belgian and Dutch businessmen have enormous power vis-a-vis their German counterparts. If you look at France, same thing. Until at least halfway through the war, and perhaps even after that, the Germans take a relatively hands-off role. You look at Marianne in Chains, this wonderful book by Robert Gildea about Western France. Vichy is running Western France, not the Germans, and the Germans occasionally pop up. They suggest something, but the policy is, if not hands-off, relatively light. Look at the German Slovakia or Croatia, another huge issue which needs to be tackled in much greater depth than I could do. The alliances. We tend to think that Germany's alliances were purely nominal, that the Germans ran everything. Mm-hmm. The Germans didn't have the troops to run everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is I was going to say, that's something that your book points out very well. There's a wonderful map in it that I believe is called Imperial Overstretch that shows the disposition of German forces over the continent and how incredibly thinly they were stretched.
Oh, yes.
They were really everywhere, but nowhere, except, you know, there were great concentrations on the Eastern Front against the Soviets, obviously, but everywhere else they were pretty thin on the ground.
Yes, the Eastern Front is the overwhelming zone of operations, and they need the Italians, the Hungarians, the Slovaks, the Croats, and Bulgarians and others. They can't do without them.
Yeah.
And although they want to tell them what to do, they can't always tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real issue here of alliance politics that needs to be looked at. And I found that the Italians in particular offered some of the most trenchant kind of insights into the nature of Nazi rule of anybody. And their records hadn't really very much been mined for that. And of course, you know, like the Brits vis-a-vis the Americans in the second half of the war, the Italians were very conscious of being the junior partners in an alliance and therefore particularly prone to scrutinize the actions of their senior partner. And they had a very clear sense of what was going wrong. And there were many Germans in the foreign ministry in particular who had the same analysis and were hoping the Italians would help them get to Hitler and persuade him to change course without much success. So the allies, I thought, were an extremely important part of this.
No, I think that's exactly right. I have studied the military history of the Eastern Front, and I can tell any of our listeners that the Allies were extraordinarily important there, and they never really get the due that they deserve. I would also, just to go back to your point about the Foreign Office, isn't it the case that Browning, he wrote a book about the German Foreign Office, didn't he?
His first book was about that, and still pioneering book was about the German Foreign Office and the Final Solution.
Yeah, that one I have not read, but I imagine that it's really fascinating, because that work comes up again in his book about the origins of the Final Solution itself. So,
well, what he showed in that, which I hadn't really appreciated at the time, but I appreciate now, is that we look back on what happened to the Jews, and we see it as a part of a single holistic program or policy. But it's not quite clear that it worked in that way, that what happened to the Jews in the occupied Eastern territories in the Soviet Union was part of the same dynamic as what happened to the Jews of Poland, who, after all, for whom a number of dedicated industrial death camps were built and then demolished, or was it part of the same process as what happened to the Jews of the rest of Europe, to get whom the SS needed the Foreign Office. And so bureaucratically, entirely different bits, often rivals of the Third Reich, had to be brought into play. And this was not a simple matter for the regime. And in a sense, what you have is the Jews being killed first, who can most easily be targeted by the regime. That's to say, in the occupied Soviet territories, where they're really at their mercy. Poland takes a little longer. The rest of Europe takes longer still. And so they are still working this through by the end of the war as their ambitions, genocidal ambitions, grow and grow.
Yeah, no, I see just what you mean. I've read another book, you know, and I'm having trouble remembering the name of the author. I think his name was Cesarini. Is that correct?
Yeah, David Cesarani.
David Cesarani, yes, exactly. And it points out the difficulty that the Germans had in coordinating, in fact, the transfer of these quite large populations of Jews to areas where they could be killed. And it shows also, I mean, it's about Eichmann. It's ostensibly a biography of Eichmann. That Eichmann, exercised actually a lot of kind of entrepreneurial spirit in doing this. And there were technical questions involved. I mean, and we tend to forget this.
There was also the politics. And I suppose this was quite important, and I don't know how well I succeeded, but I wanted to try to show that the Final Solution does not exist outside the politics of the war, and the important question in determining the fate of any Jewish community is not necessarily how anti-Semitic people were or weren't, so that you can have the same country, Romania, for instance, that in 1941 is very happy to do whatever the Germans suggest vis-a-vis killing the Jews. In fact, it will go beyond what the Nazis suggest. It will kill more of them, more horribly, faster than the Nazis had bargained for.
Mm-hmm.
But from the summer of 1942, they will go into reverse. There's a U-turn. The Germans will ask to hand over the remaining Jews, the Romanians refuse. The Romanians did not suddenly flip from one day to the next from being anti-Semites to being pro-Semites.
Mm-hmm.
That whatever their views on the Jews had been remained much the same. What had changed was their sense of how their behavior on the Jewish question would impact their future as a country.
Mm-hmm.
Up until the summer of 42, they're convinced the Germans are going to win,
mm-hmm.
and it's very important to do whatever is necessary to stay in the good books of the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
After 1942, they're not so convinced, and they're also worried that doing what the Germans say is going to impact adversely on Romanian sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
So they start to dig their heels in, and when they become convinced that Germany is going to lose, of course they oppose this to send a signal to the Allies that they're really on the Allies' side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was very important in a book of this kind, where the Holocaust is not at the center of mm-hmm. things, to show how if you decentered it, you could understand better in some instances the course of events.
Mm-hmm. No, I see what you mean. Maybe you could take us on a little tour of what the Nazis wanted from the various occupied territories, because it seems to me that there's a little bit of diversity there.
Well, there's huge diversity.
Yeah.
They wanted a number of different things. There were territories that they regarded as rightfully German. Some of these had been German before 1918. Some of them they wanted on longer run, as it were, in inverted commas, historical grounds. We're primarily talking about Western Poland,
mm-hmm.
and Western Czechoslovakia,
mm-hmm.
But also Northern Yugoslavia, and possibly later in the day Northern Italy as well. So
mm-hmm.
there was the construction of a Greater Germany. Then there were further territories to the east, stretching in Hitler and Himmler's crazed imagination all the way from the Arctic down to the Crimea,
mm-hmm.
that were going to become the marches of a new German empire in the east.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to form settlement grounds in which the indigenous inhabitants were going to either be enserfed or killed.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin this process under the plan known as General Plan East.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that the bulk of the regime's energies when it thinks about the future is directed towards the empire of General Plan East.
Mm-hmm.
And General Plan East was what was going to guarantee the SS continued role as a kind of centerpiece of the Reich. The
mm-hmm.
war, I think, turns the SS into what we think of it as.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that raised the question, what about Western Europe? What about Scandinavia? What about the Danubian region? What about Italy?
Mm-hmm.
Short answer is they thought very much less about all of that.
Mm-hmm.
They cared much less about all of that. You could always find some bit of that region where there was a German claim, Alsace and Lorraine and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But basically they just wanted these people to shut up, be quiet, hand over their Jews, and work for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was, in summary, their policy.
Yeah.
And so for an early part of the war, the occupation in France, for instance, Denmark, most obviously, is really quite, benign isn't quite the right word, but it's nothing like what you have on the eastern,
mm-hmm.
Eastern territories.
Mm-hmm.
And then it harshens very rapidly as invasion approaches and the Wehrmacht comes in. And at that point, Eastern Front rules come to Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And you get much the same kind of burning of villages,
mm-hmm.
Mass hanging of civilians, forced deportation of laborers and so on and so on,
mm-hmm.
that had become the norm in the Ukraine and Belarusia.
Mm-hmm. So this may sound like a kind of callous question to our listeners, but let me ask it anyway. What sort of logistical challenges did the Germans face on the Eastern Front as they attempted to implement this General Plan East?
Well,
all of them.
they faced the same fundamental problem that the Serbs faced in Banja Luka in
mm-hmm.
1993, which is that overwhelming military triumph made them realize that they'd won too much land and didn't have enough people.
Mm-hmm.
That was their fundamental long-term problem. They lacked the populations to control or settle this territory.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler's response to the lack of adequate manpower was terror, and so you got a terror policy imposed to try and frighten the Slav inhabitants of the region into compliance. And then on top of that, you get a kind of racial policy being pursued in the middle of the war, which is going to try and sift through and find which Slavs are in fact Germans, which could be turned into Germans, mm-hmm. to improve the numbers. That doesn't work very well, and by the end of the war, they've had to reverse themselves completely and go back to a much older kind of Wilhelmine policy from the First World War of appealing to Ukrainian or Belarusian mm-hmm. or Estonian nationalists to work with them against the communists. But the irony of that strategy is there's only one reason why that works even halfway, and that is that everybody knows the Red Army is coming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a strategy that can only work when you're losing the war.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point, of course, it's far too late. And there are many observers inside the German regime and outside it, notably the Japanese in Berlin, who I found interesting on this, who think that Hitler was completely mad mm-hmm. and that if he had pursued a pro-nationalist policy in Eastern Europe from the start and galvanized Ukrainians and Belarusians around Germany in an anti-communist crusade,
mm-hmm.
he could have still been in much of the Soviet Union through the end of the war and beyond.
Yeah, this was kind of the Habsburg option. I interviewed
right.
Tim Snyder about this, and I was surprised to learn that the Habsburgs were still thinking about the resurrection of a kind of quasi-nationalist Habsburg Empire during
right.
and even after the war. They
right.
sort of hung on to this idea. Well, I guess it's kind of, again, this sounds like a naive. Go ahead.
No, that's right. And indeed, of course, in the Wehrmacht are a number of men who had been junior officers in the Habsburg army. They had been in the Balkans or in the Ukraine in 1917 and 1918, and they remembered very, very well what that policy had been,
mm-hmm.
and they thought that the best thing to do was to repeat it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the one way to think about the Nazis is and Hitler in particular, is as an anti-Habsburg.
Mm-hmm.
Everything he does is to do the opposite of what the Habsburgs did.
Mm-hmm.
So the last thing he was going to do in 1943 or 1944 was revert to a Habsburg policy if he could help it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What happens is a kind of Habsburg policy gets implemented behind his back by the army.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So the Habsburg option is never taken precisely because of Hitler.
Yes, that's right.
Right, but again, it was taken behind his back, so to say. I know that the organization of the Vlasov army and then the recruitment of actually lots of settlers to the eastern territories from Ukraine and other places. Was Hitler aware of these things?
Intermittently, to judge from his conversations with his generals, and when he did become aware of them, he wasn't very happy. but by the time he becomes aware of them, in the second half of 44, things are rapidly going from bad to worse on the Eastern Front, and he's not in the position that he would have been 3 years earlier to block them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess one question, it's a more general question than the ones I've asked that I have, and I think that a lot of listeners have, is that, you know, one of the remarkable things I think about the German occupation, particularly of the Eastern territories, is the degree to which Hitler was able, or his generals were able, to ask the Wehrmacht and the auxiliary police and so on and so forth to do things which had previously thought to have been really too extreme to even contemplate, yet they did them, and with quite, you know, with some protest, but actually not very much. How are we to explain this? There's been a lot of debate about this, obviously. And
are two or three possibilities, I suppose. One is that if you read the very interesting new work by Isabel Hull of Cornell in her book Absolute Destruction, she argues that within the German army, dating back into the late 19th century, was a military culture that predisposed the army in what it regarded as existentially decisive situations to adopt policies of extreme violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that they are, as it were, inherently genocidal,
mm-hmm.
but they are prone to interpret crises in this kind of way as an all-or-nothing situation,
mm-hmm.
In which they lose inhibitions about behaving in ways that they wouldn't normally countenance.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the answer, I think. Second part of the answer is that, in fact, the army itself is on a rapid learning curve or de-inhibiting curve, if that's the right way of putting it, because we know that when the army goes into Poland in 39, many army officers are shocked at the behavior of the SS, or for that matter, at the fact that when army officers kill civilians in cold blood, that they're not punished. And when the military police arrest them and try to punish them, the regime protects them. They're shocked, they're dismayed, a few of them protest. But by the time you get to the invasion of the Soviet Union, in which, of course, the ideological stakes were much higher, people have learned the lesson. That is to say, they've learned that this regime is not going to tolerate protests and is going to back the men to do anything they want. And so that has a galvanizing effect on the troops. And they find themselves in many circumstances doing things that they wouldn't have done just 2 years earlier. So the war itself, I think, has a catalytic effect. And then, of course, the third thing is that they are they have the SS on their shoulder. And the army, with a pusillanimous leadership, it must be said, is very worried by the fact that Himmler is adroitly playing on Hitler's love of violence, and he's playing on the invasion of the Soviet Union to position the SS as the central agency in the Reich, in the East. And the army leadership are aware that if they don't match the SS, that they will be outflanked. And they're very, very worried about this. And so there are, as it were, internal inter-agency reasons, again, why they tolerate a level of violence against civilians that they wouldn't have done 2 or 3 years earlier.
Did anyone in the German establishment, that being the Wehrmacht or the Foreign Office or anyone close to Hitler, ever attempt to tell him that what he was trying to do in the occupied territories in the East was logistically impossible?
Oh, lots of people. But he didn't want to hear, and increasingly he becomes inaccessible to those people because he's in his East Prussian headquarters. He's surrounded by yes-men or by people like Bormann and Goebbels who think, who are even more extreme than he is. But the man that he appointed as the minister for the occupied Eastern Territories, Alfred Rosenberg, was one of those who thought this was completely the wrong way to go about things. He wanted a kind of anti-communist coalition against the Soviets. But one of the reasons he'd appointed Rosenberg was, you know, Rosenberg was an incompetent windbag. Nobody took him seriously. Then, you know, you look at figures like von Moltke in the Wehrmacht International Law Branch, who we know is deeply troubled by what he's reading about the behavior of his own men in the Wehrmacht, as well as in the SS, and the regime's complete abandonment of international law. So I was quite interested in the German international lawyers and how they respond to being disregarded and marginalized by this regime. And they're deeply worried by this. And then, most bizarrely, you get this extraordinary episode when the Governor General of Poland, Hans Frank, a man with the blood of tens of thousands of people on his hands, starts, after a feud with Himmler, starts touring the German universities in the summer of 1942, making speeches, telling the students that because of the way it's behaving in occupied territories, Germany is in danger of becoming a police state. You think, well, what's going on there? What does he think he's been doing? And given what he thinks he's been doing, what does this really mean? So there were clearly gradations in the minds of these Nazi officials as well.
No, I see what you mean. I'm very sorry to say that our time has almost run out. We've taken up a huge amount of your time, and I know that you have to go. I could talk about these things all day long, and maybe I'll just call you back to talk about them another time. But in any event, let me ask you our traditional final question. That is, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
I'm trying to work out where the idea for the United Nations came from.
Really?
Yes.
Do you have a preliminary answer to that? I don't know.
One might be a last desperate gamble by the British Empire.
That's a heck of a good question. That never really occurred to me, and that's the mark of a good question, at least in my mind.
Thank you.
It just sprung up from nothing. Well, you have to promise to be on the show next time when you get that book done. Well, anyway, Mark Mazar, thanks very much for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
Marshall.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Mark Mazar, author of Hitler's Empire, How the Nazis Ruled Europe. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.